Initially, it started from a meeting that had up in the town of New Haven. Naturally, Perrier had hired a consultant to study all of the effects of the pumping and so forth. And everything that they said, nothing would happen, everything would be fine, there would be no problem with the lake.
I talked to my hydrology buddy, and I said, Tom, he said that this isn't going to affect the spring. And Tom snorted, he's not a hydrologist, he's a hydrostitute.
And we were told up there that night by their council that we didn't have a chance in stopping them. But then we started having meetings and inviting people, and that we were just awed by the numbers of people that would come, older people from the area, farmers, retired people. It went statewide then. And finally, the incumbent governor, who had opened them with welcome arms, made a comment to Perrier that, hey, look, the people don't want you. Why don't you move out? They went to Michigan from Wisconsin.
In 1892, a 1 mile chunk of the Great Lakes and its waters was deeded by the Illinois legislature to a private company. The next legislature moved into office and voided the deed, and in 1892, the United States State Supreme Court said, these Great Lakes, they're impressed with a public trust, and under this public trust, it can't be alienated, disposed of, diverted, or transferred for a private purpose. That doctrine remains as lively and viable today as it did in the late 1800s. And that's exactly what became the basis of the lawsuit.
Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation, MCWC, files suit against Nestle. Terry Sweer, MCWC president.
MCWC was still waiting to hear the opinion when the letters from Nestle were sent to members of MCWC. Young people that had expressed their opinion in the press. And Nestle then, they were going to do a slap suit against them.
Will corporations actually step in and sue citizen activists? Usually they're suing them on something that's absolutely ridiculous, and often they'll lose. But the citizen still has to spend a lot of money on lawyers' fees, has a lot of worry. This acts as a deterrent to activism, and it is absolutely outrageous that corporations are being allowed to do this.
And I was upset about that, but then...
Chris Sweer, son of Terry Sweer.
As far as trying to intimidate, it put heat on MCWC as an organization, and it really laid the heat in on my mom.
You know, I didn't care what Nestle did to me. I was fighting Nestle, but no one's going to mess with my family, and especially my children.
Well, and clearly no company wants to be in the position of having to do that sort of thing. It was simply a letter that simply asked them to refrain from making comments that were not true.
Gosh, there's probably been three or four public hearings. Nestle was in attendance. There was newspaper press. There was television press. Just about anything I had said was either just my own opinion or else fact-based. So it was very hard to know what are they referring to.
And then I said, I'll be damned if they're going to do that to me. So Nestle came to Ferris to give a presentation. My son Chris was there.
My name is Chris Sweer.
I felt like my greatest defense was just being as public as I could.
Received a letter that I, Chris Sweer, am accused of slanderous or defamatory remarks.
My son was shaking. I mean, he was so upset.
And I'm wondering if those are charges, accusations, insinuations. I'd like to hear directly from your legal staff, if I could, please.
It was a hard thing to watch as a mother.
Fred, if you want to answer briefly, but I'd like to get to people that have questions about the project specifically, instead of maybe personally, okay?
And the whole crowd was furious.
But I mean, I tell you what, if in the end, Chris, there's time when we want to talk about that, there's no more questions about the project or water policy or groundwater, we would like to.
They never followed up and contacted me. It never materialized as far as a slap suit. Tells me it was a load of crap, just like I had suspected.
The judge said, well, if there's a diminishment. That's what the law is. It's illegal. You're done. And that was the end of it, we thought.
It probably took at least a year to be able to have our day in court. And then when you think in 3 days' time, the Court of Appeals heard Nestle's case. Nestle then was granted permission to continue to pump 200 gallons a minute.
But in doing so, the Court of Appeals changed the law. Bottled water exports or exports of water in any form are hereby prohibited.
Which is very different from most uses of water. Even agricultural uses have return flows, and it's available for reuse again and again. But once you put water in a bottle and you move it out of state, it's gone.
You made that a product. We invested. It's a private good. You can't take it from us anymore. It's too late. You open the door. Michigan is telling the world, come in and buy water rights here. And by the way, under this case, if you can demonstrate an economic benefit of shipping it somewhere else, you can have it. Changing the way water has been perceived as a public resource in a way that we may not be able to retreat if we make a mistake. And that's the problem.
When you take water out of its natural water basin and then ship it or move it, we know something about the ecological fallout from that. We don't know the full picture.
What happened to the Aral Sea? The Aral Sea was a lake, in fact, that was so huge that they called it a sea. And the countries around of the old Soviet Union decided to grow cotton in the desert and started siphoning off this water. And it's almost completely gone now.
Company comes along and says, the impact of 210 million gallons a year in a tanker truck is no different than 210 million gallons a year in a bottle. And you already let the bottled water people do that. So you have to let us do that.
And so that's how I got started in looking at bag technology.
If we massively ship water out of an area, the ecosystem is disrupted, the natural habitat damaged, biodiversity reduced, and aquifers dried. The water-rich area we chose to export from will itself desertify. The thirsty populations in the water-poor deserts we ship water to will simply consume the water and send it back to the sea via its sewers, thus still remaining a desert. Where one desert region existed before, two deserts now exist.
Water is a supply and demand commodity. The people that demand it don't have the supply. The supply is often in other parts of the world. The question is how to get it from source to market.
This sets up a kind of contest, and that is between city people and rural people.
Companies are out there constantly looking at what land the farmers own.
Going from farm to farm, hello ma'am, hello sir. Now what are you doing farming all day? It must be a lot of work. I bet you get up real early. And why don't you just let us rent or buy your water?
And we have had Texas Water come in and volunteer to build a pipeline. What I'm afraid of happening is the water will not be sold here. Into that pipeline will go out of the basin in the areas such as Santa Fe or Albuquerque.
So this is a new development that's taking place as more and more of us move into big cities and don't want to think about where water comes from. Increasingly, it's coming from the places that grow your food. This is really, really, really short-sighted.
You're using water from an ecosystem in Northern California, transporting it through long pipes and canals to Southern California to grow alfalfa. The alfalfa is then shipped to places like Japan, where it is fed to the high-end Kona beef. And then much of that beef is shipped back to the U.S. So we've set up this system of agriculture that just doesn't work anymore, and it's really based on the concept of virtual water, where we're growing crops for export in thirsty places and then moving them long distances, rather than having our food grown more locally and more sustainably. China is a very dry country, but agribusiness is moving there because there are fewer laws and labor is very cheap. Almost all apple juice sold in the United States comes from China now. We're losing our ability to even grow apples because it's cheaper to produce them elsewhere. That means that a country like China that doesn't have very much water is exporting its water to the United States through apples. Then we sign trade agreements like NAFTA so that our subsidized corn using water from desert-like areas in the U.S. can undersell the farmers in Mexico. A lot of that water actually stays in the corn and is then transported to another ecosystem and is completely lost.
For instance, here in Kenya, they grow most of the roses that are sold in Europe, and they export them. And they're growing around a beautiful, beautiful lake called Lake Naivasha, which is being depleted at an appalling rate.
All done by foreign corporations. Huge, great big flower plantations. If they keep doing this, within 5 years, it will be a putrid puddle. So here's one of the driest continents on Earth, exporting water, being told by the World Bank to export its water to get its way out of debt.
Joan Thorpe Root, the Academy Award nominated British wildlife filmmaker and African conservationist, lived in Kenya and made great efforts to save Lake Naivasha from being destroyed. Her assassins broke the nearest window to her bed, where she was sleeping. Joan awoke, desperately held her blanket out as a shield, and charged the three men. The men fired their AK-47 assault rifles from outside the window, riddling the room with bullets through the lace curtains. Two bullets struck Joan in the leg, one hit her in the hip. Joan crawled towards her bathroom, trying to stop the bleeding with her blanket, but died of massive blood loss.
You don't know when the water would flow. It flows once a week, and you don't know the date, the time. So you are forced to open up the tap. When they open their taps, it's air. And when the air blows through the taps, the meters are running, and they are charged for doing this.
There's a pipe coming up, and between the pipe and the tap, there's a water meter. And you have to pay for an electronic key to get charged up. And you can look at it and you can see the water meter counting every single drop. And as one friend of mine said, I can afford about 2 flushes a month from this thing. That's how expensive it is. You know, they just throw their hands up in despair and they go back to that river that has cholera warning signs on it.
If people don't have money to buy water, they go to polluted streams, they get sick. The state has to pay for their health care. You know, why don't you just use money for the necessary thing and to prevent other things that might come up? I'm the only one employed and I buy water, I'm going to limit or ration the people who are living in that house. That's why then you get domestic violence, because now I want to do my laundry, but because my sister is the only one employed, she determines when I do my laundry. You know, parents will take the tokens that they use into making sure that the water can run, you know, wherever they go, maybe to work and all that. And then during the day, kids don't have water. And this other woman who lived in a shack with two kids took the token and went with it to work. And the shack caught fire. And there was no water to stop the fire. And even the neighbors are saying, we don't have money to stop her fire, you know? These projects are taking away our humaneness.
Both the woman's daughters were in the shack. Both girls died. Ryan Reljack, founder, Ryan's Well Foundation, Ontario, Canada.
I was in grade one. I was six, so I didn't really think about much. I thought the whole world was go to school, don't get your parents too angry. You do a charity project each year at our school. You do your canned food drives. You do your raise money for cancer. That year, you're raising money for developing countries.
And for one penny, you could get a pencil. 5 pennies, you could get soup for the day or things like this.
And then she got to a point where she said $70 would buy a well. And then she explained to us, yeah, people are dying because they don't have clean water.
They were just disbelieving that. What do you mean you can get sick from water and that you don't have things to clean yourself with, let alone drink the water?
Then we asked, well, if they want water, how far would they have to go? And she said, like, sometimes as far as 10,000 steps. I counted the steps it took me to get from my classroom to the water fountain, and I counted 10. She said, yeah, $70 would buy a well, and it would stop it so people wouldn't have to walk so far. So I thought, okay, that sounds like a good idea, so I'll go home to my mom and dad. They have lots of money, right? And the problem would be solved, and no one would die anymore. And I thought it was a great plan.
And we thought, oh, isn't that cute? You know, he wants to build a well. Let's make dinner. Because he was so young, we really did not take him seriously. You don't get it. He said someone just died because they don't have clean water, and you didn't help them.
After a few days, they finally sat me down, and they said, what we can do is give you a chance to earn the money by doing extra chores around the house.
Never, ever thinking that he would follow through. And I got a piece of blank paper, drew a thermometer on it, 2, 4, 6, 8, all the way up to 70, to give him a sense of how long it was going to take him to get there.
After, I guess, 4 months, I raised the $70. I brought it into an organization that facilitates clean water projects in developing countries. And they looked at me and they said, it's going to cost a bit more than $70 to build an actual well.
And I've always felt bad about telling them that the well wasn't really $70, that it was actually the minimum you could get was $2,000. But I've sort of consoled myself a little by saying that if it had been more, if I'd told him $2,000 at that time, that he never would have gone. That would have been too big for a six-year-old.
So I started doing public speaking around my community. It slowly grew and grew and grew. The Ryanswell Foundation has been established. We've helped raise about $2 million, which has gone towards the completion of 266 water and sanitation projects, helping about 500,000 people.
Immediate aid like this is absolutely vital to saving lives. But if we step back, a larger question looms. An uncomfortable question we habitually avoid in our daily discussions. Why do these countries need emergency aid to provide something as basic as water? Why are they unable to build their own infrastructure of clean water delivery? Why are they poor?
Developing countries are forced to grow cash crops, export crops like tea or coffee.
Dr. George Marara Ogendi, professor of environmental geology, Arkansas State University.
We've got some resources, especially tea, which is really growing all over. The World Bank and the IMF and the other countries, especially the Western world, that buys the tea from our country always gives us a raw deal. You find that we are given so little money for this tea.
The World Trade Organization has required developing countries to remove tariffs so that products can flow in and out of the country because it benefits our corporations. They get cheap products. Now, what that means is that developing countries are very hurt.
And it's obscene. It's why these countries can't get out of debt, and it's why these countries can't develop water systems or healthcare or anything else for their kids. And there's a famous Senate hearing where a very senior World Bank official told the U.S. Senate, don't worry, we're not giving money away particularly for every dollar the United States invests in the developing world through the World Bank. American corporations get back $1.30. You know, wink, wink. We call it aid, development aid, but really it's forcing countries to open up their resources, and that's why there's such a tremendous reaction against the World Bank in the third world.
If we were to sell this tea at the right price, if we had fair trade in the markets, our tea could fetch enough money that can sustain most of our needs.
It should be a very rich country.
We cannot fight the world water crisis by just saying, let's hook up some more people and hope that does it. We have to challenge the systems that deliberately create winners from losers. And then who cares about the losers? They're losers. And it's their own fault anyway. That's the system we have to take on, and we will never, 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 never solve the world water crisis until we have the courage to talk about the world political and economic system.
Wherever a river flowing free is now treated as the supplier of raw material as if it was oil, we have the generation of water wars.
The water wars.
The Chinese, the symbol for water, not only means water, it means control, which I think is quite profound in the sense that controlling water is everything.
And the word rivals, for instance, comes from Latin meaning river. The rivals were people standing on either side of the river throwing things at each other.
And you're just going to see more of that as the technology develops to be able to suck water out of the atmosphere. Now you're going to find water from the atmosphere and clouds being stolen.
New techniques for controlling the weather are being tried. When conditions are right, rain is made to fall by seeding clouds with dry ice or silver iodine.
It's happening in China and some other places where a particular village pays for a plane to go up. They make it rain before the cloud gets to the next village. So there's real anger and real political tension.
The worst case is Southern California. And L.A. is part of what I call hydraulic civilizations, like Rome and its aqueducts was a hydraulic civilization. But there, the longest aqueduct was 60 miles. The longest you have to go, once measured it, is 1,400 miles from the furthest source of water for L.A. to a home in the town. And L.A. has not yet figured out what its limit should be. I mean, it doesn't want a limit. In the L.A. area itself, which is about 18 million, if it was on its own water, it would only be 3 million. First thing L.A. is going to do is try to put a lot of farmers out of work and close down the farms and take that water. When the water system doesn't work, then the civilization goes. The most famous conflict occurred in the Owens Valley, and Mulholland was the head of the water department there and noticed that it was pretty much a downhill run to L.A. in the 1920s. And so he got together a whole bunch of investors to divert all the water from Mono Lake and send it down through an aqueduct to L.A. It put the farmers out of business. And there was a big, violent rebellion. In two different instances, tried to blow up the aqueduct. They partially succeeded once, and then they were arrested, and then they sent in kind of goon squads to get rid of the farmers, and then they paid them off. The last great water war in the United States was 1934, when Arizona sent in the National Guard because California, again, was building a dam across the Colorado to divert the water to California without giving Arizona any. And the ferry captain that took people across the Colorado put a cannon on the front of her ferry, and they went up and threatened the dam. But it led to the Secretary of the Interior to stop the dam.
One of the most bloody water wars is still being fought over the River Kaveri that farmers of Karnataka and farmers of Tamil Nadu both required more water out of that river. A bandit of Tamil origin, Veerappan, kidnapped a Karnataka actor with the demand that large amounts of water be released to Tamil Nadu. It was really as a chess game in the water wars. I was doing a major study on conflicts over resources for the United Nations University. This fat file of mine on river water conflicts suddenly had no more coverage because the entire issue was now being presented as an issue of religion, not water demands and water conflicts.
Several years ago, the World Bank refused to guarantee a $25 million loan to finance the investment program of the local water co-op and forced Bolivia to sell its water systems to a subsidiary of Bechtel. The water prices now account in Bolivia for more than they pay for food. Well, I have a story to tell you tonight, and that is that the people rose up in Bolivia.
Cochabamba, Bolivia. Oscar Oliveira, Cochabamba citizen. I'm an industrial worker. The people and myself could not understand or comprehend how a transnational company or private investor could have ownership of water. The people had either to pay for water or go thirsty. Since they couldn't pay, they had no alternative but to fight. A popular rebellion and an organization formed from a group of people ranging from farmers to street vendors, and we started a resistance. The government sent out the military and the police to guarantee the judicial security of the company, to guarantee the profits of the company.
But it's really interesting, because you know, the World Bank has imposed the same kind of private control and takeover of many other things in developing countries: healthcare, education, their energy sector, their mines, and so on. But when it comes to water, something happens, and people say, I couldn't stop you there, or I didn't know how, or I thought maybe you would be right, but you are not taking my local water.
And there was such a complex relationship between Bechtel and the Bolivian government of that time that even the rainwater was privatized. People were prohibited from gathering rainwater.
And this is where you get the civil wars, because the army is brought in to control local dissent against these transnational corporations. Who are you protecting? There's your people without drinking water, and you're protecting foreign investors from North America and Europe?
More than 100 people suffered from bullet wounds. Numerous people were detained, and there were more than 20 snipers that killed and injured people.
17-year-old Victor Hugo Doza was killed by a shot through his face.
We're going to see a whole new geopolitical picture emerging here, where the world map will be rewritten and redesigned. They've already mapped out what are going to be the most intense areas of potential conflict in the next 10, 15, and 20 years. So the water-rich areas of the world are Brazil, Canada, Russia.
So these big superpowers are beginning to position themselves in such a way that water, like energy, is seen as part of their future security, including their military security, including their commercial security. And they're beginning to understand they have to secure future sources of water. The U.S. is doing military training around the Great Lakes, and 80 mayors of towns and cities around the lakes have asked the U.S. government to suspend this, but they're not going to. I got involved in this issue in the mid-1980s when Canada was negotiating a free trade agreement with the United States, and the free trade agreement included water as a good. There was a statement made by one of the participants that Canadian water would be flowing to the United States Midwest from the Canadian North by pipeline within 2 to 5 years. Who knew?
And move that water into a crater in the Rocky Mountains, which would be kind of like a huge mega reservoir.
And nobody will stand up in our country to the United States administration and say, this is our water, because they know that the United States would consider that as serious as if we put missiles along the Canada-U.S. border. It just would not be tolerated in the U.S.
In the new regime, where water is being treated like oil, the protection of that commodity is being ensured through a militarized defense.
And the good part of Brazil sits over top of the largest aquifer in the world, which is called the Guarani Aquifer. This is going to be a major source of fresh water in the future. Very recently, the United States has established a military base located just inside the border of Paraguay. As you know, the United States itself is running out of water. Water is becoming more and more a matter of priority in American foreign policy.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld went on a quiet mission
to a number of Latin American places, including Paraguay, to try to see what kind of further advancement could be made regarding the presence of U.S. Forces in that region. Shortly after Rumsfeld's visit, something like 500 special forces were stationed at the military base there in Paraguay.
Este caso, no momento agora,
Dr. Rosinha, Congressman, Curitiba, Brazil.
Quando
by the time we realized that the Americans were coming, it was too late. It had already been approved by the Paraguay Parliament.
It remains to be seen what will happen and what they're doing there exactly as to whether the purpose of that military base is really to secure a military presence at a very pivotal location for exercising some measure of control over the Guarani aquifer and water takings from the Guarani aquifer. In the last few weeks, there's been report in the media about George W. Bush, the president, purchasing land in Paraguay. The speculation is that that has to do with wanting to have access to the aquifer and pump water out of the aquifer.
Jenna Bush, who is the daughter of George W. Bush, had paid a quiet 10-day visit to Paraguay, in particular meeting with top officials in the government. And as it turned out, what was happening, at least this was what the speculation was in the press, was that she was about to facilitate the purchase of something like 100,000 acres of land in Paraguay in her family name. At the same time, though, that that was happening, it was discovered that George Bush Sr. already had something like 173,000 acres of land. Was this an example of the Bush oil family now switching from black gold to blue gold, turning to water and purchasing water? Clearly after that, there were a series or a string of denials on the part of the Bush family. Not directly. They did it through agencies, U.S. government agencies.
Eles negam a construção da base.
The world's largest dam is located very close to, to that area. And so that also was a matter of considerable interest for the U.S. as well.
Nelson Friedrich, Itaipu Coordination Director.
Os americanos, não diria o povo americano.
The Americans, mainly their government, have a very military, economic, and predatory view. And when they can't succeed by convincing, they use force. This economic view, this short-term focus, is the same kind of thinking that took the Americans into Vietnam and now in Iraq. Haven't they learned their lesson yet?
I mean, there's no question that that region of the world is the Middle East of water in the future.
The way forward.
And just 2 days ago, the Bolivian government gave in and kicked Bechtel out of the country. Humble Bolivians, led by a 45-year-old, kicked one of the world's biggest engineering companies out of the country for its criminal behavior and told the World Bank to go the hell with it.
Oscar Oliveira.
Bueno, 2 days después de la victoria.
2 days after the popular victory, I had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C., the first time in my life that I was ever in the United States, the second time in my life that I was ever out of my country.
And a simple shoemaker from Cochabamba, Bolivia, gave one of the most moving speeches I have ever heard.
Solo somos dueños del agua y del aire.
The only thing that is ours anymore is our water and our air.
Posibilitó la pérdida del miedo que se tiene frente a los poderes.
It enabled us to lose fear associated with these economic, financial, political, and military powers. The only force capable of transforming the world, capable of transforming society, is that capacity of unity, organization, and the mobilization of the people in front of any power.
And people were so moved, they not only clapped for him, they got up on their chairs. It was like a standing ovation that wouldn't end. It was just a stellar moment. Because this is a really scary story, and it's a true story, and we really are running out of water. It doesn't have to be that way, okay? And that's the most important thing to say, is that it's not too late. The Earth is amazingly elastic in terms of coming back. It's the ability of the Earth to renew itself is stunning.
Dr. Michael Kravchuk, hydrologist. The best way to fight water privatization is to ensure that there is enough water around your home. Then there is no demand to market water. The solution is very simple: to return water to its natural cycle and irrigate the land with rainwater.
We need to dig holes. If we dig holes in the sand, we can trick the water into staying so it doesn't run away to a river or ocean when it rains. The water will sit in the holes and soak into the ground. Then more trees will grow.
We prepare very simple, very cheap solution, and we invite youngsters and volunteers every year about summer camp, 2 weeks. About 40 to 100 people make manually, for example, small wooden dams on small streams, on water holdings, and to accumulate water.
There's a huge difference between these water catchments and dams, because dams, what happens is a large amount of water, land area gets flooded. We create these huge reservoirs, then the water becomes stagnant in them, and the mercury, it starts to spread throughout the water system itself, and it creates a whole different set of problems. In these water catchments, what happens is that the water is trapped so that it goes right into the ground itself, and therefore starts to replenish the groundwater systems.
And from yellow country, we can have green. It can bring rain to countries in drought with the creation of clouds and rain in the atmosphere.
This model can to create million and million jobs for poor people around the globe. Blue alternative solution is very easy, simple, cheap, solving of complex problem.
And it, quite frankly, is the antidote to desalinization. This is the kind of approach that we need to take in order to revitalize and rebuild our groundwater systems.
And then we have to stop going into the groundwater and taking it out in such a phenomenally cavalier way.
In the U.S., the largest amount of groundwater is being used for agriculture. And you really have to deal with agriculture to solve our water problems.
The water efficiency with hydroponic systems is 20 to 30 times more efficient than crops growing outdoors.
Dr. Merle H. Jensen, pioneer of hydroponics technology.
The reason is that we are placing the water directly to the base of the crop through drip or trickle irrigation systems. We can take that fish called tilapia, and when they grow in this water, we can take that nutrient-rich water and go on to crops with that. And any excess of water going onto the roots, it's collected. It can go back to the fish and then go through the system again. And it's these technologies that will save this planet in the next century.
What we really need to do is go back to a food system where we're not dependent on global trade and where we're really using our local water and soil resources to grow crops that are appropriate.
There's a move towards decommissioning these dams, taking them down, and that movement, that trend towards decommissioning is really important, but it sets the stage also that we need to move towards alternative ways of supplying the power that's necessary, whether it be through these microturbines.
That are in stream completely. You don't need a dam to hold back water. They just use the natural flow of rivers or coasts. Korea has been investing in this technology. Scandinavia has. I mean, they're sort of seeing their era of large dam building coming to an end as well.
As we expand urbanization to meet our growing population needs, there are alternative permeable pavement solutions which allow rainwater to infiltrate through into the subsoil. Pollutants from cars are filtered and removed and thus do not pollute the groundwater. The water quality is actually improved. Even with these advancements, the ultimate development solution is to limit the population growth of a region pending on the available water supply, which is exactly what the citizens of Bolinas, California did.
And so the towns decided that they would put a moratorium on all housing growth until they had adequate supply of water. And that water moratorium was challenged immediately and was in courts for 14 years. They just didn't want a town to be able to control growth. They considered it interference with commerce. But ultimately, we won, and yeah, it's working.
What we can learn from the Bolinas example is the whole challenge to learn to live within the limits of our watersheds.
And in this village where we really have shortage of water, we use some water that is being poured on you, on your hands, as you wash your hands sparingly. And people really value any amount of water that they have.
It's exactly the opposite of America. I mean, America could save 20 to 30% of its water really easily.
Use low-flow shower heads. Turn off the tap water when shaving or brushing teeth. If your local climate can't keep your lawn green, don't have a lawn.
If we adopted the toilet style of Israel, for instance, which has two buttons, one for urine and one for feces, the one for urine is less than a quart.
You know, everybody takes water for granted. We're going to have to grow a constituency for water issues. Think about climate change. Groups have been working on climate change for 20 years, and it's taken that long for the general public to be aware of it and for us to begin to make the legislative and regulatory changes that are necessary to really solve the problem. We need to do that for water.
To call for a United Nations convention that explicitly states that water is a human right and a public trust that must not be denied to anyone on the basis of inability to pay.
Demanding that we put this language in an international framework at the United Nations.
Because the operations of these corporations, these water barons, have now gone global, this has gone beyond nation-state law and requires us to bring in some kind of instrument at an international level to control these companies.
And that led to the really exciting change in Uruguay.
Uruguay. Buyer. Suez.
In Uruguay, se
Guillermo Garcia Duchini, attorney. Drinking water was privatized. After this happened, prices skyrocketed. The water that was being distributed was polluted. It even reached the point that services were cut off to a school. The Uruguayans, with an extensive democratic tradition, promoted the reform of their constitution.
Where citizens were able to pass a constitutional amendment that actually established the right to water and forbids privatization.
That's the model that we've been using when we talk to groups around the world and the model that we're promoting.
So we're looking for a small group of nations to begin a process within the process in the United Nations. There are some powerful countries opposing the right to water, most prominently the United States. To my eternal shame, my own country, Canada.
It has a lot of water resources, and they're concerned about having to send water to the United States.
China, Egypt, Australia, and possibly India.
They don't want to have to be responsible for providing their citizens water.
This is life and death what we're talking about, and I feel very, very strongly that we have to put ourselves out there on the line, and sometimes it can be dangerous, but we have people power on our side.
To the disapproval of the citizens of the small town of Freiburg, Maine, the water bottling company Poland Springs set up a plant. To appease the population, Poland Springs gave away a case of bottled water to the first 50 townspeople to visit their office. Led by 89-year-old Republican store owner Howard Dearborn, they poured the bottled water into Lovewell's pond. Back where it came from.
This week at the World Social Forum is being launched an historic organization, the African Water Network.
A world that is going to say no to commodification of our common goods like water.
To mobilize and protect Africa's precious water sources from abuse and from corporate theft.
Now we have a defiance campaign that says, okay, you can install your meter. After you turn your back, we take it out, we connect the pipes, and then we throw your meter away.
The court case has cost over $1 million. We've done a lot of innovative fundraising, and you have to realize that we're just normal, ordinary people who are living day to day and fighting, you know, this giant.
I play sports, hang out with my friends. I do all that regular stuff any teenager would do. It's just that I do this on the side. I just wanted to get people clean water so they wouldn't die. I guess being that young sort of helped a lot because I think I was too young to be nervous. You just see smiles light up on people's faces because they have clean water to drink. A smile doesn't light up on my face because I can have a shower in the morning.
none of these people, I don't know if there was an activist in the group. When you come from the grassroots, I think legislators look at it totally differently than they do if you are an activist. And I think that's what we had, is they couldn't go back on us and say, you guys are always out there raising a ruckus. Probably the end result isn't going to affect any of us because we're going to be gone. But we're fighting for the people that are going to use it in the future, our kids and their kids. If we don't do something to save it, what are they going to have?
Bottom line is, those people are there. And I'm talking Republicans, Democrats, and everything else in between and beyond. They're there because if money is more important than water, where are we?
Our previous mayor was indicted and tried and is currently serving time.
Et le maire, ministre de la communication,
Raymond Avrillière, and the mayor of Grenoble was put on trial and found guilty and put in jail. French city contracts with Suez and Veolia expire beginning 2009. The Paris municipality announced that its contracts will not be renewed. Paris Water will return to public hands.
We've made some serious enemies. I've made some serious enemies for myself. But as my mother would say, serious people have serious enemies.
Because it's not going to necessarily happen through governments alone. It's not going to happen through industry and by corporations. We, the people, must become the water guardians of the 21st century.
What water is in my backyard? What's the name of the watershed I live in? We should all know that, just the way we know our town and our state. And then ask the question, where does your drinking water come from, and where does your wastewater go? Just start asking the questions. You don't even have to do anything. Just ask the questions.
In memory of Victor Hugo and the others killed in Bolivia, Lee Kyung-hae, Joan Thorpe Root, and the two South African girls who died while their neighbors watched the fire, and the countless other undocumented casualties of the world's first water wars. You've been listening to Blue Gold, a film by Sam Bazo, based on the book Blue Gold by Tony Clark and Maude Barlow, narrated by Malcolm McDowell. Noah Cottrell, third grader, Michigan.
What I think is really weird is, even though my brother is 6, turning 7, and I'm 8, turning 9, I still can't do the monkey bars, and my brother can.
They were selling Ice Mountain at the school cafeteria. My principal came into my class, and then I told my teacher that I had to talk to her about the Ice Mountain thing. This is my problem poster about what Ice Mountain's doing.
They're draining the lakes. When they drain the lakes, they're also draining the springs and the wells. And this is just like one of my little glow-in-the-dark things.
Before Ice Mountain, after Ice Mountain, mud flat. And then over here, the solution. Send letters to the decision makers. Boycott Ice Mountain. I showed these posters to the school board, my class, and student council.
Michigan, despite lawsuit in court.
Well, Mrs. Hart, she said that there was going to be no more Ice Mountain in the entire school district. A bunch of articles just because of one little thing I did. And also, most importantly, let your voice be heard. Like the one time when I was at a meat store, I saw that they sold Ice Mountain, and then I talked to the store manager, and then he said, okay. And then the next time when I went, no Ice Mountain the entire store. I felt very happy because I knew that I did the right thing.
The film Blue Gold. And thanks to Red Pill for making that available online. To close out the show, I'd like to read you a short article that was part of the fall newsletter for the Sierra Club Atlantic Division. It, of course, concerns gas drilling. The author is Ken Baer, and it's titled, "Gas Industry Threatens the State's Food Shed." In a December 2008 report to Governor David Patterson, the New York State Council on Food Policy recognized that, quote, "agriculture is a critically important industry to the state," close quote. In 2007, agriculture generated nearly $5 billion in New York. Three of the top five agriculture counties, Genesee, Cayuga, and Wyoming, lie within the Marcellus Shale region. Some of the chemicals the gas and oil industry uses to extract gas are hormone disruptors. Gas drilling entities have already wrought havoc in many states. Some residents have brain lesions, cancer, and reproductive problems, as well as farm animals with extraordinary rates of stillbirths. The contamination of water, soil, and air has especially affected Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Ohio, and Texas. And next door in Pennsylvania, some people can turn on their kitchen faucets, ignite a cigarette lighter, and watch their drinking water burst into flames. And now these gas drillers want New York State. If the fossil fuel industry has its way, 14 million New Yorkers, about 9 million in the metropolitan area, and another 5 million in the southern tier, will be directly threatened with irreversible pollution. Speaking of his proposed legislation, Assemblyman James Brennan says, "The process used for natural gas extraction, referred to as hydraulic fracturing, utilizes chemicals that are often toxic, that are non-biodegradable, and that are virtually impossible to remove once they enter the natural environment. We must ban this form of gas drilling everywhere in this state so every New Yorker can drink water and eat food that is not riddled with highly toxic drilling chemicals. And so that the food shed for New York City and other urban centers is not further compromised. All 17 watersheds in our state are sensitive and special because they are crucial for the livelihoods and the survival of all the people who live in them." And that by Ken Baer, former chair of the Atlantic chapter of the Sierra Club. And finally, a treat. When I was browsing the internet looking for something else entirely, I came across a singer who had his recordings up on YouTube. His name, and this is his real name, happens to be Mike Sinatra, and he lives in New Jersey, and he plays covers. He is so talented that he sings the songs, in many cases, better than their original artists. He just sings and plays an acoustic guitar, but his voice is so full of emotion. There's so much feeling in it that I thought more people should know about him than the few who happened to stumble across him, as I did. He calls himself Songman Sinatra, and you can find him on YouTube. So let me play you a couple of selections of songs that are, of course, appropriate to what we've been hearing during the rest of the show. And thanks once again for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests. You can download the show at unwelcomeguests.org.
Soon as you're born, they make you feel small, for giving you no time instead of it all, till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. Working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate if you're clever and despise a fool, till you're so freaking crazy you can't follow their rules. working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. You think that you're clever and classless and free, but you're still freaking peasants as far as I can see. Working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they're telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like all the folks on the hill. Working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, then just follow. Come gather round people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times they are a change. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the halls. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. I'll soon shake your windows and I'll rattle your walls. For the times they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters, they're beyond your command, and your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can lend your hands. For the times they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading.